and calling women voters. We declare that women watch the debate through the same inescapable prism, a raunchy 3-minute recording in which Mr. Trump told of kissing and touching women however he pleased. We called this Trump's new agonizing and self-created reality, and declared his campaign imperiled by his careless approach to gender. Less than a month later, Trump would win a majority of white women. Chapter 49. Bill's Last Stand. Sleepless in Chappaqua, October 2016. Bill Clinton was pissed off at the world. Trump parading out those women, Robbie and his fucking data, the lawyers insisting he lay off dozens of employees and shutter the Clinton Global Initiative, Brooklyn blaming him for that smug James Comey taking over the email investigation. Clinton turned 70 in August. He'd always thought Hillary would go to the White House and he could mostly stay in Chappaqua and continue to run the foundation. Even though Hillary moved back there after the State Department, Chappie had always been Clinton's stomping grounds. In the paid speech boondoggle years, Hillary would sometimes spend nights in a suite in the Lowell on the Upper East Side. People said Chelsea needed a $10 million apartment so that her mom could sleep over, but that hardly ever happened. "I hope I'll get permission to keep this foundation going," Clinton told Queen Latifah on her eponymous talk show in 2014. Wishful thinking. 2 years later, and it was obvious that there would be no way for Clinton to maintain any semblance of his post-presidential life. His ego took a hit. At Hillary's Roosevelt Island kickoff speech, I overheard a gaggle of young girls point at Bill as he made his way through the crowd and shout, "Look, there's Hillary's husband!" The Clinton Foundation had been so dragged through the dirt that there's no way he could keep it going. I'd seen the foundation's work in Africa, seen deaf Ugandan children given the gift of hearing for the first time, and still helped fire the opening shot with the 2013 investigation into mismanagement and dysfunction at the philanthropy, including the Yorkie, that I co-wrote with Nick Confessori. The front page story, my second on the beat, hadn't been bad for Hillary. It made Chelsea look gallant in her effort to professionalize her dad's philanthropy in anticipation of her mom's arrival. But the story still provided Fox News with days of fodder and caused donors to panic. Clinton released an open letter pushing back against the Times. Outsider Guy told me that by co-writing the story, I'd single-handedly taken AIDS medication away from thousands of kids. Not Nick, not the Times, not my editors, not Doug Bann, who'd built an enterprise off Bill Clinton, Inc., but me. I dismissed this as his usual hyperbole, but 3 years later, after scrutiny of the charity and its top donors hadn't let up and the future looked uncertain, I realized he hadn't been all that far off. Even if Clinton could somehow avoid the White House Easter egg roll and continue to run his foundation after the election, his philanthropy wouldn't have much money coming in. Along with shutting down the Clinton Global Initiative, the foundation said it would stop accepting foreign donations. There would be no more late nights with rich donors hanging on Clinton's every word as he yakked about soybean production in Rwanda. No more chartered international flights on which the guys could charm donors' buxom wives. Clinton had been so morose thanking the 200 or so CGI staff members, many of whom would soon be out of a job, standing in the hub of the Midtown offices, slumped shoulders, bags heavy under his eyes, his gaunt frame swallowed under a navy blue blazer, that Tina Flournoy, his chief of staff, prompted everyone to break out in happy birthday. "I don't think I've ever done anything that I've loved as much as this foundation," Clinton said, the sad, lovable St. Bernard. "This is like a root canal for me." But it wasn't just the foundation or the women. The entire election had become a repudiation of the Bill Clinton years. NAFTA, the 1994 crime bill, his dismantling of financial regulations, his gutting welfare by $55 billion. People, Democrats even, linked the rise of Trump, the general degradation of the office of the presidency, to Clinton. He lied about getting a blowjob in the Oval Office, so why not turn to a reality TV star who brags about sexual assault and seems proud to be propped up by the Russians? The whole country was an open, angry revolt against a presidency that until recently most people would have said was pretty good. What part of the 1990s didn't you like, the peace or the prosperity? Incomes rose for everyone, not just the rich. No major wars unless you count the Balkans and Somalia. In the spring, Clinton had this embarrassing showdown with Black Lives Matter protesters. They waved signs like, "Clinton crime bill destroyed our communities," and "Black youth are not super predators," a term Hillary had used in 1996 to describe gang violence. Instead of ignoring them, Clinton extended a long finger and entered, as Jezebel called it, peak white mansplain mode. "I don't know how you would characterize the gang leaders who got 13-year-old kids hopped up on crack and sent them out to the street to murder other African-American children," Clinton said, his bloodshot eyes bulging. "Maybe you thought they were good citizens. She didn't. She didn't." He raised his voice. He would have been at a yell if his voice had been stronger. "You are defending the people who kill the people whose lives you say matter. Tell the truth." Black leaders said it was a sister soldier moment for an entire generation. They weren't wrong. As a proxy for his wife's primary campaign, which at that point was kept afloat almost entirely by black voters, the confrontation was a disaster. But the people who knew Clinton best said he was looking ahead to the fall, and especially the white working-class voters who put him in office in the first place. He figured that, for the most part, those voters would have agreed with him. Not long after Hillary started her campaign, Clinton told the NAACP that his 1994 crime bill sent too many low-level criminals to prison for way too long and made the problem worse. Even then, people saw only politics. "I keep waiting for somebody to spring a trap door on me. Oh, look at Bill Clinton," I once heard Clinton say at a book party in New York that I wasn't really supposed to be at. "He really is still slick." Like most reporters, I loved covering Clinton, being around him, watching him work a room, even, or especially, at his most self-indulgent. He constantly disobeyed his staff and security detail. In White Plains, before the New York primary, he shook hands at a Hillary field office and then walked across a busy two-lane street. He blocked traffic and almost caused a multi-car pileup with a single outstretched palm so he could drop in on the Dominican bodega across the street. "Amy, Amy, take a look at this. This woman is Peruvian, but she has a Hindi tattoo on her hands," he said. "Trump's America," I said. Just then, a tiny Mexican woman with a red purse sprinted across the street and dove into Clinton's arms. I don't know how she got past Secret Service, except that she seemed hardly over 4 feet tall. Clinton hunched down and, in a reflexive move, wrapped his whole body around her. Both arms, his chin slumped down on her shoulder, their cheeks touched. It could have been the last scene in Dirty Dancing, except with an elderly Mexican woman and a white-haired former president. By the fall, Clinton was tired of reaming Robbie out on conference calls, screaming that the campaign shouldn't ignore the white voters he'd won in 92 and 96, and whom Hillary won over in upstate New York in the Senate years and in her 2008 campaign. Clinton tried to tell them that he knew Trump better than any of the other candidates did. Hillary, thinking Trump was a bigger donor than he actually was, had insisted they attend his 2005 wedding to Melania Knaus, despite a couple of aides warning her not to go. Hillary ended up sitting behind Shaquille O'Neal at the ceremony and could hardly see anything except the 90 meters of white satin tulle of Melania's Dior gown passed down the aisle. Clinton thought Trump's anti-trade economic message could be lethal. He said something like, "This guy's making Hillary look like the elitist," almost daily. Nobody reminded Clinton that his past left the campaign paralyzed in hitting Trump's treatment of women, or that shouts of "Bill Clinton's a rapist" now interrupted almost all of Hillary's rallies. The campaign treated Clinton like a distraction, a gifted but problematic child who needed to be kept busy. Regular updates to Brooklyn from Clinton's team included, "Fair to say we didn't break anything." By October, Clinton had splintered off from the campaign, venturing on a series of Stronger Together bus tours. He went to places Hillary wouldn't go to, tried to talk to the Bubba Trump continuum, North Florida, Eastern Ohio, the Mahoning Valley, Iowa, rural Pennsylvania, stops in Wisconsin and Michigan. At a diner in Buffalo, Clinton ate a French fry off a customer's plate, with permission. In East Africa, I wrote in my notebook the Zulu greeting Clinton used wherever he went, Sawambona, which means, I see you, to which villagers would reply, Nikona, or I am here. He felt the same way about Trump voters. An enormous number of people feel like they're not seen and nobody gets them, he said. You can actually go places where you can make a difference in the vote because people don't expect you to show up there, Clinton said. I found it was the most efficient use of the things I could do for the campaign, but I also just like it. It's much more like the ways I campaigned when I was a young person starting out, when I was out at 19 years old working for other people. But if there was one thing Clinton would remind you and keep reminding you until you got it, it was that he wasn't 19 anymore. This came out in all types of weird ways. At a black church in Detroit, he'd had body envy. Anytime I watch an NBA basketball game, I think if I had a body like that, I would have gone into a different line of work, Clinton said. On a stop at a Mexican restaurant in Santa Fe, a 24-year-old Bernie supporter, Josh Brody, ripped into Clinton about the welfare overhaul and Wall Street. It's a nice little narrative, Clinton said, hovering over his booth at Tia Sofia's. The Democratic Party is now a party that's supposed to represent the working class without many working class constituents, Brody said, blaming the shift on Clinton moving the party towards big business. If you never have to make a decision, then you can go back to the past and cherry-pick everything for a narrative that is blatantly false. What you're saying is false, Clinton said. He could have walked away. His aides kept urging him to walk away. Other people are waiting, his body man John Davidson said. I think we're going to agree to disagree here, guys. But Clinton wasn't finished. People like you show up in presidential elections. A lot of them stay home. That gives you the benefit of being able to criticize everybody, Clinton said. His aides were physically nudging him to the next booth. If the best thing to do is just say no and lob bombs, you don't get anything done. I didn't believe the rumors that Bill was sick or losing it. My Irish power broker friends, the same ones who invited me to a luncheon the year before at which Hillary sat next to Jerry Adams, palling around with terrorists, a source texted me, invited me to a St. Patrick's Day event with Clinton. Mouths fell open as he extemporaneously wove a speech to crying political polarization into a crescendo with flavors of Yeats. We can never let our hearts turn to stone, and we can never let things fall apart so much that we cannot build a dynamic center where the future of our children counts more than the scars of our past, he said. But something had changed in Clinton. He meandered through his usual remarks, telling his extremely elderly, almost entirely white crowds how Hillary was the best damn change maker. And he spoke with a kind of schmaltzy desperation I hadn't heard before. You guys did well when I was president. Let's come in and talk, he told a couple hundred people at a rally in Fort Collins, Colorado. He raised his dry voice to speak over the hum of a turboprop plane circling overhead with the words, Go Trump, painted on its wings. In Pueblo, Clinton told the crowd, Look, his base is where I grew up. I was born in Arkansas to a mother of Scots-Irish lineage, he said. These are good people, honest people, he said, but always and forever we've been manipulated by scoundrels. In the back, a man shouted, Lock that bitch up. Chapter 50. Chekhov's Gun. New York City, October 28, 2016. File under headlines that didn't hold up. Stop trying to make Anthony Weiner's sexting a political issue. New York Magazine, August 30, 2016. The day October delivered its final big surprise, my colleague Mike Schmidt was visiting from D.C. He sat in the cubicle next to me in the newsroom as we both worked our sources. 20 minutes after the campaign announced in a show of confidence that Hillary would hold an early voting rally in Arizona, a state that had gone red in 11 of the past 12 presidential campaigns but seemed potentially in play, news broke that James Comey sent a letter to Congress stating the FBI had found additional emails related to Hillary's private server. Trump wasted little time declaring, This changes everything. Schmidt heard the emails had been unearthed during a separate investigation into Anthony Weiner's sexting with an underage girl. He kept yelling into the phone, "They've got Weiner by the balls!" until I finally G-chatted him that he had to stop saying that. The Times News alert went out that the emails had been found on a computer Huma had used. The Weiner connection both was unbelievable and yet, in some sad way, made perfect sense. Hillary, married to an alleged sexual predator, could lose to Trump, an alleged sexual predator, because of Weiner, an alleged sexual predator. No one understood why Huma had stayed with Anthony for so long, but the best explanation I heard came from a close girlfriend of Hillary's, who reminded me that Huma had grown up amid the tumult of the Clintons' own marriage. "You can't blame her," this friend said, using the same excuse the guys had used for Chelsea. "She was raised by wolves." I thought back to 2013 when I heard about the Carlos Danger scandal, to the stories I wrote about the guys hoping to contain Huma's personal life so it didn't spill into Hillary's political future. They protected Huma as if she were a beloved little sister and a vital appendage of Hillary. Big donors were less sympathetic, imploring Hillary to put Huma in a less visible role. At least one top donor confronted Huma directly in 2013, pleading with her, for Hillary's sake, to step down. "I'm good at what I do, and that's Hillary's decision," Huma replied. Now, in the last act, with 11 days before the election, Huma's problems exploded in one final self-inflicted seismic wound. "It's like Chekhov's gun," I said as we stood around discussing the news. A colleague who overheard this said, "I didn't know they knew who Chekhov was in Texas." Barry's senior editor came by my desk to ask, "She's not going to lose, right?" I gave my extremely professional assessment of the situation. "Brooklyn is freaking the fuck out," I said. "Her trust numbers are already shit." In August, after the Pop Goes the Wiener cover in the New York Post, Trump told us, "I only worry for the country and that Hillary Clinton was careless and negligent in allowing Wiener to have such proximity to highly classified information." Who knows what he learned and who he told? It's just another example of Hillary Clinton's bad judgment. It is possible that our country and its security have been greatly compromised by this. His statement had seemed so far-fetched that Pat Healy and I took a fair amount of outrage from the hashtag I'm with her contingent for including it in a front-page story. "This changes everything," Donald Trump exults as Hillary Clinton's team scrambles. But Trump had been half-right. The FBI didn't find any additional classified or incriminating emails on Weiner's computer, but the bad judgment line stuck. Hillary was en route to Cedar Rapids when the news broke, accompanied by her childhood friend Betsy Ebeling, a sweet, gray-haired Midwesterner whom the campaign rolled out every time they needed a testament to Hillary's warmth and down-to-earthiness, and the photographer Annie Leibovich. Robbie Mook had been on board to brief the travelers about Hillary's trip to Arizona and how she'd expand the map. Hillary didn't initially see the news, nor did most of the press, thanks to the plane's shoddy Wi-Fi. When the Stronger Together touched down, disbelief, followed by alarm, spread throughout the front cabin. The travelers bustled onto the tarmac, hoping to scream a question, "Secretary, what about the FBI?" Hillary lingered on board. She had the photo shoot with Annie Leibovich to finish. She'd later tell friends that the development was just another crisis in a career full of them. In the newsroom, we turned up the volume to watch Hillary's brief press conference that evening. Part of me longed to be there shouting questions myself. But mostly, I thought of Sarah. I'd spent the past year bringing chocolate babka and challah loaves to Sarah Ehrman, the feminist firebrand whom Hillary lived with after law school when she worked on the Watergate Committee. 42 years earlier, in August 1974, Sarah drove Hillary, then 26, to Fayetteville, Arkansas to be with Bill Clinton. Sarah tried to talk her out of the move the whole way down. "We'd drive along and I'd say, 'Hillary, for God's sake, he'll just be a country lawyer down there.' And each time, Hillary would answer the same way, telling Sarah, 'I love him and I want to be with him.'" Sarah was 97 but feisty, still dispensing tough love to her most famous protege, Hillary, and a revolving door of Washington women who came to her sunny Kalorama apartment bearing gifts and seeking career advice. We'd become close over the many afternoons I'd tried to woo her into talking on the record about the two-day, 1,193-mile journey that changed Hillary's life. For over a year, Hillary had turned down my many interview requests to do a piece on their relationship, and Sarah remained reluctant. After the election, Sarah showed me emails from brown loafers instructing her not to talk to me, basically saying that I hated Hillary and couldn't be trusted to be fair, a warning Hillary had asked him to pass on. But Sarah finally agreed to talk to me anyway, writing back to brown loafers something like, "For God's sake, she's just a nice Jewish girl from Texas." Sarah reminisced about Hillary's sloppy room with brown clothes and books and a bicycle strewn about. She told me about the cheap motels, encounters with drunken strangers, pecan pie, tchotchke purchases, and deeply personal conversations they shared on the two-day drive down Interstate 81 in Sarah's beat-up 68 Buick sedan, an old rattle trap, she called it. The journey, I wrote in the Times, offered a glimpse of Hillary the public seldom sees, wide-eyed and eager, vulnerable and afraid, at the cusp of a momentous decision that would alter the course of her life. The road trip story and accompanying video with Sarah sitting on a sofa in a seafoam sweater set that brought out her eyes was my favorite article that I ever wrote on the beat, maybe in my entire career. It was published on the Times website hours before news of the Comey letter broke. Hardly anyone read it. The story had been scheduled to run prominently on the next day's front page, but never even made it into print. Several months after the election, I would write Sarah's obituary. Hillary told the story of their road trip at the memorial service. The Comey news would lead the entire front page, three stories, seven bylines, including mine, a four-column photo of Hillary, Huma standing over her shoulder, arms akimbo. The layout would live in infamy, proof to Hillary and the hashtag still with her crowd that the Times blew the email story out of proportion, the climax of its decades-long anti-Clinton vendetta. "I am confident whatever they are will not change the conclusion reached in July," Hillary told reporters when barraged with questions that afternoon about the newly unearthed emails. Asked about the Anthony Weiner connection, Hillary said, "We've heard these rumors. We don't know what to believe." Less than 4 minutes later, she closed her green binder and turned to leave. The travelers yelled, "Secretary, is this going to make your campaign so much harder? Secretary, how did you learn about this?" Hillary pointed at the scrum, "Same way you did, from the press. Are you worried this could sink your campaign, Secretary?" Hillary, now almost out of sight, shook her head and laughed. Chapter 51, Hillary's Death March to Victory. You are in Akron, Ohio for an Ohio Democratic Party voter registration event with Secretary Hillary Clinton at the Goodyear Hall and Theater on Monday, October 3rd, 2016. Hillary reminded the audience that LeBron James had endorsed her. "Now, I may become president, but he will be king of Ohio for as long as there is a king," she said. Dozens of empty chairs sat in the press area. Extension cords dangled unused off folding tables. Cherry pickers set up to give photographers an aerial shot of Hillary sat idle. I had to remind myself that there was a time, during the Harkin steak fry, before Hillary was a candidate, and while Trump was still a reality TV star, when she had been the media's obsession. 200 reporters had stampeded across the lawn for a glimpse of the most irresistible, dramatic story of the horribly dull political year to come. Hillary, the would-be candidate, able to capture the world's attention with a single flip of sirloin, now hardly registered. Pretty soon, we were calling it Hillary's Death March to Victory. I don't know how else to explain it except to say that it didn't feel like a winning campaign. Hillary went through the motions. "Hello, insert swing state city here." 8 years earlier, I'd experienced an actual winning campaign, and not just some winning re-election campaign, but a spectacular, holy shit, America is going to elect a black man winning campaign. I saw the euphoria, the millions who never thought elections mattered to them, standing in line for hours just to get a glimpse. You never get used to seeing a crowd of a million people. Every time we walked into a rally, in stadiums mostly, my mouth would drop. Obama must have felt the same way because he never wanted to get off the damn stage. He'd look out at the crowds, the hope signs, the tears in people's eyes. He'd ramble on for 15 or 20 minutes, interrupted with frequent shouts of, "I love you," and his cool, "I love you back." He knew that was the best it would ever get. Hillary's campaign did not feel like that. In fact, if there was a single unifying force behind her candidacy, it was her obvious desire to get the whole thing over with. "This election is 10 days away," she said at a rally in Des Moines. 11, but we're more than halfway through today. Aside from the local touches, each speech, crowd, city, blurred into one. The women, mostly boomers, who wore "Nasty Women for Hillary" buttons. The senior citizens who sat in folding chairs to one side of the stage, their walkers or canes nearby. The gay men who had blue H's painted on their cheeks. The "Love Trump's Hate" signs. Even her catchiest slogan was about Trump. Katy Perry's roar and Rachel Platten's fight song filling the high school gyms with the scoreboard set to Time 2016. Home 45, away 45. "They'll lock her up," protesters outside, the scent of the nearby porta-potties. The travelers didn't know if we were in Akron or Toledo, Cleveland or Cincinnati, Raleigh-Durham or Charlotte, so the press advance kids started to tape helpful reminders to our workspaces in each city. "You are in Toledo, Ohio, for a Secretary Hillary Clinton economic speech at Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Plaza on Monday, October 3rd, 2016. "Did you see the last debate?" had replaced "Deal me in" as Hillary's favorite line. She was so far ahead in the polls after the third debate that I wrote lines like, "Mrs. Clinton is likely to prevail against Mr. Trump in 2 weeks," and "Mr. Trump's party increasingly concedes he is unlikely to recover in the polls." Brooklyn was so cocksure that they turned to Senate and congressional races. The campaign, flush with $150 million in cash, spent $1 million on voter turnout in Indiana and Missouri. Robbie vowed to dramatically expand efforts in Arizona, spending an additional $2 million on advertising and sending their most valuable and reluctant campaigner, Michelle Obama, there. The campaign bought ads in Texas and Utah. Organizers in Michigan and Wisconsin still pleaded for resources, but Robbie saw opportunities to expand the map and make sure Democrats controlled the Senate. This new mission made Hillary's stump speech even more stilted. In Lake Worth, Florida, the crowd sang "Happy Birthday" to Hillary, who turned 69 that day. "Thank you so much for singing to me," she said. "I hope that one of the best gifts you can give yourselves would be sending Patrick Murphy to the United States Senate." Adding to the gloom of superiority in the campaign was the angst about WikiLeaks' daily release of more #Podesta emails. Each dump brought fresh conspiracies, including right-wing theories that a reference to "Madre" in one email, "Please don't burn the source or Madre may pay the price," was code name for a secret CNN source trying to help Hillary. In reality, Madre is one of the guy's pit bull rescues. With weeks left, I was dying to spend as much time as possible on the road, but the email dumps often tethered me to my desk. I'd been on my way to White Plains Airport to fly to North Carolina, where Hillary and Michelle Obama would have their first and only joint rally, only to be summoned back to the newsroom by my editors to read through a new pile of emails related to the Clinton Foundation. This election isn't happening in my cubicle. I traveled on weekends, holidays. I went to a black church in Charlotte with Hillary on Rosh Hashanah. I'd had to scramble to find the Times editor on goy duty. "You are in Cincinnati, Ohio, for a rally with Secretary Clinton at Small Riverfront Park on Monday, October 31st, 2016. Note, Happy Halloween." Early one Sunday morning, the travelers who'd spent the night at a Marriott in a research park in Durham, North Carolina, rode over to Hillary's hotel, a luxury spa with zen gardens and outdoor fire pits overlooking a thick forest of Carolina hemlocks and magenta rhododendrons. We barreled into the earth-hued lobby, spritzing ourselves with raspberry-scented lotion in the gift shop, digging underneath the suede chaise lounge chairs for power outlets, and generally destroying any shred of zen that the hotel had once offered. The everydays don't stay here. No, no, they do not. Look, is that free coffee? From there, we went to a black church in Durham. This is the day the Lord hath made, followed by a couple early voting rallies. We got back to Westchester after 10 p.m. I hadn't written a single word, but I did take a stab at TLC's waterfalls on a karaoke machine a photographer had set up on the plane. Thanks to Hillary's celebrity endorsements, the travelers spent almost every night at a free concert. Katy Perry, Philly. Adele, Miami. Elton John, New York. J-Lo and Marc Anthony, Miami. Chance the Rapper, Jay-Z and Beyoncé, plus backup dancers in blue pantsuits, Cleveland. The Wire reporters sat staring into the glowing eyes of their laptops during the Beyoncé-Jay-Z concert. In khaki pants and sweater sets, these D.C. reporters looked almost as incongruous in the jubilant, almost entirely black audience as Mike Schmidt had waddling onto Waikiki Beach. Annie and I stood up and danced. I was anticipating the unflattering photo and the Breitbart headline, "Fawning press goes wild for Hillary in Cleveland," but I didn't care. And when Beyoncé displayed in a multimedia explosion of hip-hop and girl power the phrase that 24 years earlier had cast Hillary as Lady Macbeth and an affront to stay-at-home moms, I even choked up. I suppose I could have stayed home and baked cookies and had teas, but what I decided to do was to fulfill my profession, flashed on the screen, signed Hillary Clinton. It was a major milestone. Maybe Hillary really would win. Of course, when I asked Jen if that meant Hillary had reclaimed the cookies comment, for which she spent 20 years apologizing, Jen said Beyoncé had creative control and Hillary hadn't known about it. Yeah, that was, interesting, Jen said. I looked around at the thousands of pumped young voters who poured out of the Cleveland arena. They didn't look anything like Hillary's usual crowds. For a second, I thought they'd deliver Ohio. But then I thought back to Iowa and the Demi Lovato concert and what Pete D'Alessandro had said. They just came for the ribs. In the final weeks, I went on the road even though I knew it meant I'd miss out on bylines. In meeting after meeting, on daily 8 a.m. conference calls, colleagues who covered Trump explained that there was no chance in hell he could win. I agreed, thinking this was just how Hillary would win, the long-suffering feminist heroine who would make history not in a festooned love fest, but in a dreary, mechanical slog. Robbie had just done a conference call with donors telling them Hillary was up by 7 points in Michigan, 20 points in Wisconsin, with 10% of the early vote tallied. Hispanic turnout was up 139% in Florida. She'd win North Carolina by 3 or 4 points. Comey did not change the fundamentals of the race. We saw tightening before Comey, and there's no dramatic shift in our polling, he said. It's the tightening of the GOP coming home. Hillary joined the call. We know Arizona is a stretch, she said, noting that she had 16,000 people at her rally in Phoenix. We're doing all we can to turn it blue. It wasn't mathematically possible that Trump could win, and yet I still couldn't kick the feeling that Hillary wouldn't win either. You are in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, for a Secretary Hillary Clinton Democratic organizing event at the Great Hall at Heinz Field. It is Friday, November 4th, 2016. In Pittsburgh, the travelers had the run of Heinz Field while Hillary and Mark Cuban, she loved having her own bombastic billionaire turned reality TV star along, held a rally in an indoor pavilion lined with Steelers memorabilia. It was wonderful to be outside, not stuck on a bus or in a high school gym on a sunny 65-degree fall day. We raced out of breath to the 50-yard line. It was just 10 of us, the ones who'd covered Hillary the longest. We looked out at the sun refracting off 68,000 empty orange seats. Classic HRC rally crowd, Annie said. Just kidding, just kidding. The front sanctum of the Stronger Together plane started to look like Hillary's West Wing. Longtime friends, the loyalists of the loyalists, rejoined the campaign, including Cheryl Mills, Maggie Williams, Capricia Marshall, Huma, back from a brief banishment in Brooklyn, and OG, who'd been mostly kept in his padded room or DC office during the campaign. Capricia Marshall, will you please report to the principal's office? One of the guys said into the intercom, summoning her to Hillary's chambers. For all the talk early on of bringing in fresh talent to run her campaign team, Hillary would end it with the same box of broken toys who'd enabled all her worst instincts since the 90s. I emailed Carolyn. I'm waiting for Sid Blumenthal to join us. In 2015, before she started her campaign, Hillary talked to aides about what she called her Al Gore problem. If she was going to be herself, substantive, prepared, prone to policy talk, she knew she'd also come off as stiff, a square. In these final weeks, she finally seemed at peace with that. She did a whole riff on making lists. I have a plan for just about everything. You know, maybe it's a woman thing. We make lists, right? I love making lists. And then I love crossing things off. She'd build get-out-the-vote rallies around her college calculator. You can actually go to hillaryclinton.com/calculator to see how much money you and your family could save with our plan. Speaking to college students, she'd assign them a little homework assignment. If you add the number of jobs that our economy added when Barack Obama and Bill Clinton were president, and if you compare it with the two Bush presidencies and the Reagan presidency, you'll see what I mean. In Grand Rapids, Hillary led a call and response about interest rates. There are so many people paying 8, 10, 12, higher. Now where did that? How much? She cupped her ear to hear a few numeric shouts from the crowd. 12.7%? 14.1%. I gotta tell you, that is outrageous. She kept making references to Hamilton, even though tickets to the Broadway hit would have been prohibitively expensive for most everydays. Wow, I'll tell you, I've seen it 3 times and I listen to the score all the time, Hillary told a crowd at an outdoor rally in Charlotte. I lifted the right side of Peter Nicholas's noise-canceling earmuffs and said it didn't end well for Hamilton. But more than any data or talk about Democrats retaking the Senate, I knew Hillary thought she'd be president when she brought back the 3D printer. I am not one of those folks who think, well, we just can't make it in America anymore. We can lead the world in precision manufacturing, in 3D printing. She almost only did call-in interviews with Black and Hispanic radio shows, and she even resisted doing those. She seemed uninterested, botching the softest of softballs. Hillary told DJ Envy of the Breakfast Club that she loved to dance, and so any chance I get, I will dance. I'm not sure that it would be anything that you'd say was good dancing, but you don't do the robot and stuff like that? DJ Envy asked. No, I'm not a robot. I don't do that robot stuff, yeah. When Sam Silk, another Black radio jockey, welcomed Hillary and said, yeah, I'm pumped up on why to vote, Hillary laughed and said, well, that makes one of us. Yeah, makes one of us, huh? Okay. She did so many radio call-ins that I asked Brown Loafers if Hillary would call into Michael Barbaro's new podcast, The Run-Up. The New York Times podcast audience isn't our target demographic, he replied. Usually by the final stretch, candidate reporters are so brainwashed from living in the bubble that we all believe our horse will win even if the facts say otherwise. Think about it. For months, years sometimes, we've only talked to diehard supporters. We've only heard spin from one side. We've been at hundreds of rallies where the only voters we see want our assigned candidate to win. Traveling in the motorcade means the campaign rushes us past the occasional protesters, a passing glare that has faded by the time we're captive on the bus again. Romney's traveling press fell hard for it in 2012. So did the McCain-Palin reporters in 2008. In the waning weeks of the 2008 primary fight against Obama, when Hillary added more events to her already packed schedule and party leaders urged her to drop out, I still believed she had a chance. You just don't understand. The polls don't see what I see. In 2016, the opposite happened. The Hillary press and the Trump press both thought we were the sad sacks doomed to cover the losing candidate. Chapter 52, The TikTok, Number 1, November 7th, 2016. 11:10 a.m. Traveling press and pool wheels down Pittsburgh International Airport Atlantic Aviation FBO. I had my ideal seat for the final leg in the second row of the press cabin next to Annie in the middle seat and Ruby at the window. Varun, or Arun as we called him after Hillary's flub, who assigned us our seats, had come through. Either that or he just didn't want to deal with my diva fit if I hadn't gotten the aisle. We loaded off the plane at our first stop, suddenly aware of where we'd landed and how strange it was given that Hillary was so far ahead in Pennsylvania. "Does anyone know why we're back in Pittsburgh?" a traveler asked. "Yeah, weren't we, like, just here, like, 2 days ago? And in Philly yesterday? Yeah, why couldn't we have, like, stayed in Philly and gone straight to Pittsburgh?" On Sunday, we'd gone to the Mount Airy Church of God in Christ in Philly, where backstage Hillary and the gospel singer B.B. Winans belted out Amazing Grace so loudly that her voice echoed through the closed doors. I remembered what Robbie Mook said the other day about how the campaign's analytics showed Hillary would do better in the Philly suburbs than any Democrat had in decades. "Turnout obvs," I told the travelers. "I work for the New York Times. I'm number one." "Yeah," they agreed. "She wants to kill him in Pennsylvania." 1:05 p.m. You are in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, for a Secretary Hillary Clinton Get Out the Vote event at the University of Pittsburgh on Monday, November 7th, 2016. For months, Hillary had been telling voters that what the country really needed, in addition to a $275 billion infrastructure plan and a revised corporate tax code, was more love and kindness. But there'd been little of either this election year. She'd spent the past several months pillorying Trump as unfit and dangerous, a loose cannon, and a puppet. I thought back to the day before the 2008 election when I was the pool reporter in Obama's motorcade riding over to Grant Park after the results came in, and how different, how optimistic the country felt then. David Plouffe, Obama's 2008 campaign manager, summed up 2016 as hope and change, not so much, more like hate and castrate. Now, with hours left before the polls opened, Hillary stopped making it all about Trump. "I'm here to ask you to vote for yourselves, vote for your families, vote for your futures, vote on the issues that matter to you, because they are on the ballot, not just my name and my opponent's name." "I love you," a group of young girls shouted in unison. It wasn't that in Hillary's 575 days on the campaign trail, adoring fans hadn't professed their love for her. They had. But in Pittsburgh, Hillary looked as though she finally believed them. She paused, tilted her head to the right, and looked at the girls. Abandoning the teleprompter, she said, "I love you all, too." 5:05 p.m. You are in Grand Rapids, Michigan, for a Secretary Hillary Clinton Get Out the Vote rally at Grand Valley State University Fieldhouse. It is Monday, November 7th, 2016. "Loading," a press aide yelled. Hillary had just wrapped up her second and final rally in Michigan since she lost to Bernie back in March. Two rallies down, three more stops to go. I walked through the parking lot, my laptop open in my arms, even though I wouldn't file my story until the end of the day's swing around 3 a.m. A lone protester held a sign, "Liar, liar, pantsuit on fire." I turned my head to the right and saw Hillary's staff van. The sliding door was open, and inside, spread out long ways, his legs on the upholstered bench, shoes practically jutting into the sun, was OG. The original guy. who years earlier had suckered me with access and charisma and then mind-fucked me into believing my colleagues would destroy me and stomp on my cold, irrelevant corpse before we got to Iowa. The one whose email manifestos had ruined so many weekends. The one whose good side I should have tried to stay on but stupidly chose to provoke, polar bear style. The one who had no idea that the next day he'd watch his dream job in the White House slip away to Hope Hicks, a 28-year-old former Ralph Lauren model. I wanted for so long to prove to him, and by extension to Hillary, that I could survive the steel cage match. We locked eyes. I smiled and kept walking. 8:02 p.m. Traveling press and pool depart Philadelphia International Airport en route Independence Hall. I held my phone up to the speakers trying to capture Bruce Springsteen's raspy lyrics as they filled the air outside Independence Hall. In college, Bobby spent summers on a J-1 visa working as a carny on the Jersey Shore. He had bleached blonde hair and operated a balloon ride on the boardwalk in Wildwood. He tells the story of his friend's mom seeing this horde of gangly Irish schoolboys off at the Dublin airport to America. "Mind the AIDS!" she'd yelled at them as they boarded. I'm more of a Tom Petty person, but for Bobby, nothing epitomizes America and why he wanted to move here and become a citizen more than Springsteen. He was so excited to vote for the first time on Tuesday. I wished he'd been there to hear Long Walk Home performed live outside to 30,000 people before the election. Springsteen called the song a prayer for post-election and declared that on Tuesday, Trump's ideas and that campaign are going down. I called Bobby several times, but it kept going to voicemail. I recorded a few minutes of music and then said, "I love you so much. Thank you for everything. I wouldn't be here tonight without you. You're everything," and hung up. 9:11 p.m. GOTV rally on Independence Mall with Hillary Clinton, President Obama, Michelle Obama, President Clinton, Chelsea Clinton, and John Bon Jovi. Please note, this event is outside. Hillary and Obama came on stage arm in arm. The sky had cleared and a sliver of half moon glowed over Independence Hall. They waved and pointed at the crowd, Hillary's biggest yet. These two Democrats, whose rivalry had been the backdrop of my re-entry into American politics, now stood as one unit, stronger together, or something like that. 12:52 a.m., Election Day. Midnight, get out the vote rally, Reynolds Coliseum, North Carolina State University, Raleigh. Dear HFA Traveling Press, congratulations on making it to the last rally of this campaign. We hope this midnight get out the vote rally is a memorable last stop. We've enjoyed working with you lots. Press advance. You can count on Hillary's midnight rally starting closer to 1 a.m. Bon Jovi decided to tag along on the flight to Raleigh-Durham. We saw him boarding, a silhouette in black who waved to the press. When we landed and walked into the Reynolds Coliseum at North Carolina State University, Lady Gaga in black aviator glasses and a high-collared velvet brigandine with a red armband sat at a grand piano singing "I Want Your Love." You could tell the campaign had screwed up because the narrow passageway they'd carved out for the press in between the throngs of college students put us so close to Gaga that we could have grabbed her as she stood on the piano for the finale of Born This Way. "This way, traveling press, keep moving," a press aide yelled as we stood and gawked at the pop star. Bon Jovi and Gaga did an impromptu duet of "Living on a Prayer." Gaga slid off her glasses and told the crowd, "I could never have fathomed that I would experience in my lifetime that a woman would become president of the United States." And the 6,000 people who seemed unfazed by Hillary's tardiness exploded. Everywhere I looked, I saw women of all ages, most of them of the nasty variety, crying as they watched Hillary on stage. She joined hands with Bon Jovi and Gaga. This odd threesome thrust their arms overhead. Hillary couldn't help herself. "Until the polls close tomorrow, we're going to be living on a prayer," she said. The travelers rolled our eyes at each other and giggled. Would she still make pop culture puns as president? The campaign must have relaxed its corporate-issued poster rules because everywhere people held handmade signs that said, "It's time, and Hillary for me," a chant of, "I believe that she will win, I believe that she will win," broke out. At that moment, I believed that she would win, too. 1:55 a.m. Traveling press and pool wheels up at Raleigh-Durham International Airport, en route Westchester County Airport. The next hour had the feel of an in-flight victory party. The flight attendants could hardly get us all to sit for takeoff, and then everyone, including Bill, Hillary, Chelsea, and a cabin packed with their closest aides and friends, bounced out of their seats and poured into the aisle. Bon Jovi ventured to the back cabin where a couple of travelers asked for selfies. I scooted around the fangirls who encircled him and saw OG. We talked as if we had no history, as if nothing had passed between us. We were two acquaintances who ran into each other in the grocery store checkout line. "How have you been?" I asked. "Not bad, and you?" I don't remember how the Russians and WikiLeaks came up, but when it did, he said something like, "Can you imagine the epic scandal if the Times emails were hacked? It would make Jason Blair look like nothing." I nodded and agreed, but I wasn't sure why he was telling me this. Then he dropped that he knew the cybersecurity firm that the Times had hired to secure our servers. "Nice guys over there. I'm friends with a couple of them." "Well, okay, nice seeing you," I said, and I walked back to my seat, a pit in my stomach, knowing he'd soon be running the country. 3:45 a.m. Traveling press and pool wheels down Westchester County Airport, Ross Aviation. Because Hillary didn't want the day to end and wanted to torment the press with one final rendition of Fight Song, Brooklyn assembled a couple hundred of her most loyal neighbors, staff, and supporters for one last soiree on the tarmac in White Plains. Hillary stepped off the Stronger Together Express for the last time, wearing her thick glasses. I stood on the platform set up for the photographers and watched her disembark. I thought about her 70% approval rating when she was Secretary of State, the last time she'd regularly worn glasses and scrunchies and a multicolored coat she'd bought at a market in Afghanistan in the 90s. The country liked Hillary then. Maybe they could like her again when she became the FWP. She spent 5 minutes shaking hands and stepped into her van for Chappaqua. Chapter 53, The TikTok Number 2, New York City, November 8th, 2016, 5:58 p.m. Hillary's motorcade arrived at the Peninsula Hotel, a limestone and steel tower on Fifth Avenue with a mint-colored rooftop as translucent and dignified as a jade Buddha. Only family and her innermost circle were invited to watch returns come in at the Peninsula before everyone headed across town to the Javits. Hillary stepped out of her van, believing that when she got back in later that night, probably around 10 p.m., maybe even earlier, her aides assured her, she'd be the president-elect. She strode into the Peninsula's amber-lit lobby with its scent of fresh hydrangea and Chanel No. 5, and a row of attendants in white gloves who looked ready to pantomime. Just around the corner, steel barricades set up along Fifth Avenue fenced in a small crowd of Trump supporters, probably from Staten Island, who chanted, "Drain the swamp!" A couple of protesters who held Andy Warhol-like silhouettes of Trump with the words, "pro-rape," and enough NYPD officers in riot gear to stop the Tiananmen Square massacre. If I had to choose a single symbol of Hillary's outsize optimism that night, it wouldn't be the 2-minute fireworks display over the Hudson River that would burst over the Javits Center's glass-domed ceiling until the Coast Guard put the kibosh on the idea, or the speech devoting her victory to Dorothy, which she had recited over and over to make sure she didn't cry as she had in her Brooklyn speech. It was her choice of hotels. For as long as I'd covered the Clintons, they'd been savvy enough to know that New York Democrats hold major events at the sturdy Times Square Sheraton, whose workers are proud AFL-CIO members. Whether you're rich or rank and file, if you're a Democrat and you're in Manhattan, chances are you've flooded the hotel's hallways and narrow elevator banks for one cause or another. Al Sharpton held his annual convention of civil rights leaders there, and for years the Clinton Global Initiative had transformed the Sheraton's gloomy ballrooms into what felt like a multi-day walk-through Clinton infomercial. Even before Hillary had a campaign in 2014, Ready for Hillary chose the Sheraton for its day-long confab with donors. Hillary started her campaign with a burrito bowl at a Chipotle in Maumee, Ohio, and a promise to reshuffle the deck in favor of the middle class. To end it, she chose the Peninsula, where the 19th-floor Peninsula Suite at $25,000 a night offers a grand piano, velvet armchairs in earthy tones, Italian silk curtains, and a dining room table that seats 8. One thing the Peninsula didn't offer was easy access to the Javits, which stood on the opposite end of the fat middle of the island in the muck of construction and gridlock on the far west side, an area conveniently reached from hundreds of lesser hotels, including the Times Square Sheraton. When I heard early that morning that Hillary would watch the results come in at the Peninsula, I'd just assumed the five-star hotel was another ballsy move to troll Trump one last time. His anticipated election night rage compounded by knowing that out the window, a single block down Fifth Avenue from Trump Tower, a victorious Hillary, living as if she too were a billionaire, was leaving her tastefully appointed hotel suite to ride in a motorcade across town as the nation's new president-elect. When I later floated this theory by an aide, she shot it down, explaining simply, "Hillary just loves nice hotels and thought she'd win." 8:34 p.m. People had compared Elon Kriegel, the mastermind behind the Clinton campaign's data analytics, to John Nash, the paranoid schizophrenic and Nobel Prize-winning mathematician whom Russell Crowe played in A Beautiful Mind. With his husky black eyebrows, 5 o'clock shadow, and crinkles around his eyes when he smiled, Elon had been the behind-the-scenes beating heart of a campaign that believed it would win, not based on crowd size or voters coming out of their skin each time the candidate spoke, but on something more absolute than any of that. Math. His statistical model showed Hillary couldn't lose. Robbie said it proved the enormous amount of room we have to maneuver in the map. Everyone, Democrats, donors, the media, had bowed down in worship of the science and computer-crunching quants who had brought presidential campaigns, once the purview of door-knocking and crusty piles of opposition research and the blind magic of voters' whims, into the modern era. Until the 8:34 p.m. conference call on election night. "Our models in Florida were off," Elon explained to Hillary's top campaign aides. The data projections said that the surge of early voting and Latinos, the newly arrived Puerto Ricans, for example, drawn into the process by the campaign's brilliant bilingual get-out-the-vote effort that reached out to them in churches and nail salons and the streets, blasting reggaeton from caravanas, would give Florida to Hillary. But as the count in Broward County came in, Elon realized the math, that seemingly infallible thing, had been wrong. Turnout among Latinos wasn't what they'd projected, while white voters had stormed the polls in the panhandle. Robbie, who put his faith entirely in his calculator, had reassured Hillary minutes earlier that she was in good shape. "If we lost Florida, we don't actually have to win Pennsylvania," he'd reminded her. On a conference call with senior campaign officials, Robbie put on his sunny, bordering on delusional, disposition. "That's okay. This is all okay. Our path never relied on Florida. We can lose there and still be fine," he said in response to Elon's update. Long pause. Exhale. But Robbie, Elon started slowly, realizing what the next statement would mean. "If our models were wrong in Florida, they're wrong everywhere." 9:02 p.m. "Robbie, what the fuck is happening?" It wasn't an uncommon occurrence for Mandy Grunwald, who'd been in Clinton pressure cookers since 1992, to express her concerns using a choice set of expletives strung together with the elan of a Harvard via Nightingale Bamford alum. But this time was different. The campaign had three power centers on election night. Backstage at the Javits Center, where in between conference calls, aides tried to avoid the press and keep donors and big-name celebrities, including Cher, Lady Gaga, and Katy Perry, calm. The Peninsula, where Robbie delivered updates to Bill and Hillary and Chelsea, usually via Huma or Cheryl. And what several aides